treat each other within the environment of the ecclesia. Chapter 13 shows to us that, in effect, the same principles apply wherever we are. Whilst, of course, we recognise that there are differences between those within the brotherhood and those outside, nevertheless, there are certain divine principles which are eternal principles and which will apply in all cases. Such things as honesty and integrity would be things which will apply in all cases. The apostle tonight is going to make a very, very powerful point when he shows to us that regardless of the quality of the leadership which we see in the world, nevertheless, those men are, in the words of the King James Version, ordained of God. Doesn't mean they're righteous men. Doesn't mean that God approves of the things that they do. But he knows they are there. He suffers them to be there. And we may have to suffer them as well in a different sense of the term. But the point he makes is that in serving them, we are serving God. And whilst I think all of us can give lip service to that particular principle, in practice it's by no means an easy thing. And I think we're going to find these words of chapter 13 very helpful, particularly those of us who do have an occupation where we go out and we mix with the world a lot more. I use that as distinct from perhaps the housewife who may not mix with people in the world quite so much. Nevertheless, those are principles which I think the Apostle Paul is going to expound for us in a very practical way. I'd like to, by way of introduction, reread the words on the top of page 107, so I'm going to read them. You might just as well follow them with me. We concluded with these words last week, but I think they're an excellent introduction, based very largely on some notes by Brother Percy Mansfield. In the first seven verses of this chapter, Paul discusses the subject of the duty which believers owe to civil government. This was a difficult issue because he had previously spent some considerable time establishing the fact that the Lord Jesus Christ was their lawgiver, sovereign, and judge. It became therefore a question of great importance and difficulty what kind of allegiance they were to render to earthly magistrates. Furthermore, the kingdom of this world was pagan and generally anti-Christian. To what extent should the saints submit to the jurisdiction of a system adapted to the convenience of heathenism? The Jews had borne the yoke of Roman oppression with great uneasiness. The whole heathen magistracy they regarded as founded in a system of idolatry. It was opposed to God and it was an abomination in his sight. The Gentile converts would also naturally look with abhorrence on the system of idolatry which they had just forsaken. Jew and Gentile had been taught to look for a new order of things when Christ and the saints would take over the governments of the nations. This chapter settles the principles upon which the ecclesia should act in these matters. So that gives us a bit of an overview as to where we are heading in this particular chapter. So, verse 1. Verse 1 says, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers." It's an expression which we come across earlier back in chapter 2, which combines together both Jew and Gentile. So he's once again bringing these two groups of humanity together, the Jew and the Gentile. He said that every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. The expression "the higher powers" simply means those who are in authority. The NIV translates it as the governing authorities. So it's quite clear what he's saying. There's nothing at all difficult in this verse. He says, every one of you, be it Jew or Gentile, you've got to be subject to these governing authorities. Now here, of course, is the interesting point of the argument. For he says, there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Now, as we said in our introductory comments, it's very easy to give lip service to that. But to acknowledge that a government which has just spent somewhere between 40 and 50 million on a referendum which got rejected, and everybody says, well, what a useless sort of government. Yes, that government is there, quote, ordained of God. And therefore we have a certain responsibility to it. We don't consider that we have a responsibility to vote in that referendum. It is better to obey God rather than men. We are not interested, really, in the future of that particular government. So there's that very fine line of distinction between saying we don't want anything to do with that government, and yet we're prepared to give absolute allegiance to it within the confines of that which does not violate the principles of Christ. In other words, we will obey the laws of the land, those particular laws which are there for the benefit of society. Now, having made all those qualifications, when we go through these verses in Romans chapter 13, Paul is only talking in the context of those laws which are there for the benefit of society. He doesn't really make any reference to the fact that he himself... No, it wasn't. It was Peter, wasn't it? Who was it said it's better to obey God rather than men? That was Peter, wasn't it? It's in the Acts. Right. Well, he's not allowing for the fact that even he himself would have on occasions disputed the authority of certain people. He's talking about the fact that there is a system of jurisdiction in the earth. We've got to acknowledge that it is there ordained of God. And our very obedience to it is in fact a trial for us to see whether or not we do recognise authority. It's like saying that our family system on earth, the governmental jurisdiction system on earth, all of those are like a cameo of what really exists in heaven. And if we can't give honest service to the earthly authorities, then it's foolish to say that we can give honest service to our heavenly Father, to our heavenly Master. And so the point that Paul is really bringing out here is, test your service to your God by seeing what sort of service you give to your earthly Master or to the authorities. And you might say, well, they're not worth serving. To which Paul counters, well, they're there and they're ordained of God. And I think it's best if we let him develop the argument, because he does develop it very powerfully by the time we get to about verses 4 and 5. So without stringing out anything unnecessarily, the opening verse is very clear, but there are a couple of cross-references which I think are very good. One's in Timothy, the first of Timothy chapter 2, and the other one is in Titus. The first of Timothy, chapter 2, and verse 1 and verse 2. Paul says to Timothy, I exhort therefore that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. That's the point he makes to Timothy. To Titus, chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, to be ready to every good work, to speak evil of no man, to be no brawlers, but gentle, showing all meekness unto all men. Now, I think both of those verses are very clear. We've got to recognise that the powers that be are ordained of God. We pray for them, as Paul says to Timothy, particularly that they might allow an environment in which the truth might prosper, in which our characters might be developed. And whilst we say the truth might prosper and our characters might be developed, it doesn't mean, of course, that we're going to be always living in a situation of peace and prosperity. Because in the wisdom of God, our character may be developed under a totally different environment, even one of adversity. But God knows that, and God is aware of the character of those particular ruling powers. So, verse 1 is very clear back in Romans chapter 12. There is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. The diglot says, there is not an authority except from God, and those existing have been arranged under God. And so we know then that God permits their development and their existence. Very well known verse, of course, in Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17 tells us that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the lowliest, the humblest, he who is set at naught, the basest, depending which translation you're going to, of men. And we know that it has a dual message in that verse, that God does set up over the kingdom of men from time to time whomsoever he will, and of course in the future sense he will set up over it even the lowliest, the one that was set of Lord of men, even the Lord Jesus Christ. So having established that in verse 1, we are going to move off that verse unless anybody has any other comment on that or any other quotes they would like to present.
Titus 2.
Verse 9.
Without reference to the reference of the servant's time in us,
principles are parallel, such as the patient problem of Satan comes out clearly, where he says, by the 2 verse 9, exhort servants to be obedient unto their own masters, and to please them well in all things, not answering again, not purloining, but showing all good fidelity. And he finishes his comment, that they may adorn to the doctrine of God our Saviour in all things, so that his obedience and respect of authority, which from a servant to his employer, is a manifestation of the doctrine of God.
Manifestation.
Well,
yes, that's all right, because I'm going to use it again later on. That's the very point he's going to make.
Sure, yeah.
Right. Did you hear that out the back? Didn't. Next time a bit louder. Right. Okay, Barry quoted from Titus 2 verses 9 and 10. We won't read the verses again. And he pointed out very rightfully so that this very act of giving due service to earthly masters is very much involved with the doctrine of God manifestation. Now, a doctrine, of course, which we talk a lot about, but not always in this context. We'll leave Romans 13 to develop that for us a little bit in a moment. All right. Verse 2. Romans 13, whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation, or if you like, condemnation. Now you see how he's building up this argument which we anticipated a moment ago. Because the powers that be are ordained of God, he says, whosoever therefore resisteth the power is actually resisting the ordinance of God. And we point out once again that Paul in this section is only talking really about that area where, of course, the laws are right and proper. And in fact, most of the laws of the land are. Most of the laws of the land are put there for the well-being of society in a general sense. There are not a lot of laws that we have to object to. They, of course, would come into the area of those principles such as military service and voting and maybe such things. But the general law of the land is the sort of thing which he's talking about here. Therefore, if we resist that law, he says we're resisting the ordinance of God. The expression, the ordinance of God, the diaglot says, one who resists this power is opposing the institution of God. So he's building up this picture of the system that we see about us being, in fact, an institution of God. Not that he approves of the things that they do, but he has instituted it, he has ordained it, and as far as we are concerned, therefore, in giving dues and honour and respect where required, we are doing it as to God, and in fact, he says, it's a power which has been instituted of God. The latter part of the verse goes on to say, and they that resist shall receive to themselves condemnation. The diaglot makes the point, and the opponents will procure punishment for themselves. So then those who resist authority will procure this punishment from the authority, but they will also receive the punishment from God who ordained the authority. In fact, that's probably an important point, and you'll find it in the notes, halfway down page 108, right at the bottom of verse 2, and I've got that highlighted because I think it's very important. Those who resist authority will procure this punishment from the authority, but also from God who ordained the authority. Now maybe we don't think in terms of standing before the judgment seat of Christ and answering for the way in which we have responded to our earthly responsibilities in regard to the powers that be. And of course you can think of all sorts of areas where you don't think of it as crime. I suppose in the world they talk about white collar crime, don't they? Where you're just juggling things on a bit of paper and, well, that's not really stealing. Or just overestimating your expenditures on an income tax return or something like that. Or forgetting some source of income that you had that, well, you'd really half forgotten about it anyway. And all of those sort of things. You know, you might say, well, it's not a big crime. Now, it's not a big crime in the sense of magnitude, but it's the frame of mind which desires to do that, which is the significant thing. And whether you're just making a juggle of a cent on an income tax return or whether you're robbing $10,000 from the bank doesn't really make much difference. The principle, in fact, is the same. And Paul is going to be developing that here and saying, well, look, you've got to see you have a responsibility to serve the authorities. And he's going to give the reasons why in a moment. He's first of all going to develop the aspect, if you like, of fear, that if you don't do it, you're going to be punished. You could well be punished by the authority, who he says in a moment wields the sword. You will also be punished by God. But why are you going to be? Well, he'll tell us. So as far as we've gone so far here in verses 1 and 2, verse 1 simply tells us we've got to be subject to the higher powers because they have been instituted of God. Verse 2 tells us that if we resist these powers, we are in fact resisting the institution of God, and those people will receive punishment. Punishment both from the authorities if they are caught, certainly a punishment from God, for the reasons to be explained in the next two or three verses. Any comments on verse 2? We're making rapid progress tonight, aren't we? Alright, we go on to verse 3. Now he says in verse 3, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. So this is the context in which he's talking about rulers. He's not talking about a despotic society in which the ruler is an outright criminal. He's talking about a society in which the rulers are not a terror to good works. And I suppose, by and large, most countries over the years have had this sort of ruler. They're certainly not perfect men, but they do have a desire to see a society where people are living happily and, I suppose, where they can keep their job and they don't have too many worries. So that's the context. In which case, they are not generally a terror to people who do the right thing. We say we can find the exception to that, but by and large they are not. They are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. As a general truth, those who are virtuous have nothing to fear from the law. That's true, and that's the point we've made. It is universally true, however, that the design of their appointment by God was not to injure and oppress the good, but to detect and to punish the evil. I rather like the comment from Brother Carter, which we've got at the bottom of page 108 of our notes. When the letter to the Romans was written, Paul had always received favourable treatment from Roman officials. But it deserves notice that in the later epistles, when the attitude of the authorities to the Christians had changed, the same commands are repeated. Writing to Timothy, Paul says, I exhort therefore that, first of all, supplications, prayers and intercessions and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. A quote which we previously read. To Titus he writes, put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, to be ready to every good work, to speak evil of no man, to be no brawlers, but gentle, showing meekness unto all men. But I'd like to turn to the quote in Peter, because that's another good quote that supplements what we're saying. The first of Peter, chapter 2 and verses 13 to 16. In fact, I think we can make it 13 to 17. 1 Peter 2, verse 13. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Honour all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honour the king. So Paul to the Romans, Paul to Timothy, Paul to Titus, and Peter writing his epistle, all find a need to expound this particular point of giving proper service to the earthly authorities. Going back to Romans then in chapter 13 verse 3, Paul asks the question then, wilt thou
then not be afraid of the power. The NIV says, do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right and he will commend you. So the argument then is very straightforward. In the opening verse, the first verse, he said that the powers are ordained of God. Verse 2 says that if you don't obey the powers, you'll be punished by them, and by implication, you'll be punished by God. And verse 3 then says, if you want to be free from fear, then do what is right, and you will be commended. And of course, there are many examples of people like Daniel and others who found themselves in just such positions. And he says, that's what we've got to aim for. Verse 3 verses. Run out of notes, I don't think, but anyway, any comments then on the first three? I think it's fairly simple, really, isn't it, by comparison with some of the earlier chapters where we found some fairly complex reasoning. This is very, very straightforward, and yet, however, the practical issues are perhaps more complex than the principles we were looking at earlier, how we come to grips with this. All right, we shall move on then to verse 4. Verse 4 says, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So he is therefore the minister of God. He's the minister of God for good, we are told. He's the minister of God to thee for good. Now we can start to think of our own situations here, because there are probably a lot of things in life that we find that the world at large complains about. What would they complain about? The police force, I suppose, would be a classic example, wouldn't it? And whilst there may generally may be corruption in the police force, particularly if we live in Queensland, nevertheless, most of the policemen are there to do a particular duty. And that duty really is to make society a better place to live in, to make the roads safer, to protect the average person in the community from criminals and that sort of thing. But it's surprising how people traditionally, of course, speak disparagingly of such people. They speak disparagingly of the laws. I suppose the classic one would be road rules and things like that. And so, when one decides to do 80 in a 60-kilometre zone, say, well, so what? Well, it doesn't hurt to think about Romans 13 when you do that. What was the spirit that said, I can do it, I'm safe? Yes, I know the rules are made for people, for their good, but for this area is okay. Well, Paul's making the point that there's a frame of thinking in this. There's a frame of thinking which says, I'm really above the law. And I've got a niggling suspicion that at times Christadelphians particularly feel that way. Because we know that this system's going to be replaced, and in many ways we despise it, it is possible to think that we're above the law, and therefore we'll make up our mind as to what's right or wrong in a given situation. I know the law says that, but that's going to be done away with one day anyway. I can do it this way. And I think we all need to just give thought to that, as to whether or not we do in fact feel ourselves at times a bit above the law. We will make the moral judgment as to whether we think it's right, and we could be quite right. We could be quite safe in doing something, a certain thing. We might not be morally wrong in doing another thing. But the government has said, for whatever reason, don't do it. So Paul says, you don't do it. This person is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do which is evil, then you've got cause to be afraid. I mean, if a brother's driving a car with one of these radar detectors sitting on his front panel thing there, I guess he's living fulfilment of that verse, isn't he? I don't know whether anyone has got one. It'd be embarrassing if they have, but anyway, that's the illustration. And that's the case, isn't it? I mean, it's tantamount to saying, well, I expect that I'm going to break the laws, so I better have at least something there to find out if someone's going to catch me, because I don't want to be caught. Well, of course you don't want to be caught. That's what Paul's saying, because if you get caught, you'll be punished. And you deserve to be punished. But he says there's more to it than that. He says that the point of the thing is that there is a principle. God has instituted this government, and as far as the saints are concerned, it's a testing ground. Can you obey the laws of that government? Because if you can't obey the laws of that government, don't you try to tell me you can obey the laws of the government which is above. because the same principle applies. And it's like we were looking at earlier in other situations about obeying earthly masters. Giving a full day's service to an earthly master is a necessity, because if we can't do that honestly, then don't let's fool ourselves that we give an honest day's service to our heavenly master. And so there is this parallel situation then. If thou do that which is evil, you should be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. So in contrast then to the question which is asked in verse 3, wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Paul now points out that those who do evil need to be afraid. The NIV again says, in regard to this verse, he does not bear the sword for nothing. Now the sword was an instrument of punishment as well as an emblem of authority. Of course there are such things as ceremonial swords, and traditionally, particularly in the first century, someone wearing the sword, it stood as a symbol of authority. However, many of them were quite capable of using it as well. So Paul's meaning here is that the one in authority does not wear this badge as an unmeaning show, but that he will use it to execute laws and enforce his authority. The diaglot says, for he is God's servant for thy good. But if thou do evil, be afraid. For he bears the sword not in vain, since he is God's avenging servant for wrath on him doing evil. So that's the sort of thing that we need to think about when we see the various people who are administering the laws of the land. We see them in a different light now. We say they are the ministers of God. We didn't comment on the meaning of the word minister, but it's there in the note. It simply means a servant or an attendant. But we do come across this word minister again shortly, and it's going to be in verse 6. And there is another word which we'll look at in a little bit more depth, because that one has some interesting connotations with it. So he is the servant, he is the attendant, he is the minister, he is the one there for that is the minister of God for our good. And at the same time, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Right, now we come to the fifth verse where Paul brings all of these ideas together, and he really spells out the principle very powerfully in this fifth verse. Wherefore, he says, ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. Now this is the verse which climaxes the argument. We've already anticipated this, we've said quite a bit about it already, but this is Paul's conclusion. Bear in mind what we've seen so far. Verse 1 says the authorities are there instituted by God. Verse 2 says that that people who resist the power resist God, and therefore they deserve to be punished. Verse 3 says, are you then going to be afraid of this power? Verse 4 says, well, there's no need to be afraid, because he's the minister to thee for good. But if you're not going to obey those authorities, then he's going to be the executor of wrath upon you. So then, verse 5 says, for that reason then you must needs be subject. You've got to be subject to it for two reasons. The first one, he says, is for wrath. Well, that's a simple one, isn't it? If you don't obey the laws of the land, you will experience wrath. In what sense are you going to experience wrath? Well, he's already told us there are two ways in which the wrath will be poured out. One, you'll get it now from the earthly authority, and two, you'll get it later from God. There may even be in a sense in which you'll get it now from God, but that's what we might call the ways of providence, and we can't always exactly see that. But he says there's a very good reason for wrath's sake. I'd like to follow the notes fairly closely at the bottom of page 109. Second paragraph under verse 5. The apostle has given two reasons why we should be such subject. One, the government was appointed by God, and two, violation of the law, of the laws, would result in punishment. He now extends this by adding, ye must needs be subject. The word means, by implication, or literally, The Greek word there, which I can't pronounce, it's a strange. How do you pronounce that one? Joe, A-N-A-G-K-E. A-G-K-E. Looks funny, doesn't it? Perhaps you can't pronounce it either, can you? A-N-A-G. Anyway, whatever that word is, it means constraint. By implication, it means distress. This is a word stronger than that which implies mere fitness or propriety. It means that it is a matter of high obligation and of necessity. What? Anagi, is it? A-N-A-G-K. I suppose that's what is anagi. Right. So he's pointing out then that it's a matter of high obligation. So we have a high obligation, not only for wrath, not only for fear of punishment or the fact that wrath will be executed on evildoers, as verse 4 says, or as the NIV says, not only because of possible punishment, but also for conscience' sake. Now this is the real crux of the issue. You see, whilst there's nothing wrong with being afraid of punishment, if it just stops there, of course then it becomes a bit like somebody living under the law, and we say, well, I'll obey the law because I don't want to be punished. Well, a law can be very useful. It can help to regulate society. But the fact must also be that there has to be a conscience. So he says, also for conscience sake. Diaglot says, on account of conscience. Now Paul himself, in his defence before Felix, stated that he endeavoured always to have a conscience void of offence toward God and toward men. A very powerful point, as Acts 24 verse 16 points out. To have a conscience void of offence toward God and toward men. So while fear of punishment is a deterrent to doing evil, the Christian must not direct his course solely by that fear. The directing motive in his life is his knowledge of what is right and the consequent desire to do what is right because it is required by God and is well pleasing to him. Other words from Brother Carter. So, and I've highlighted this next section in the notes because I think it's a good summary. Paul thus enumerates two reasons why we should be subject to the higher powers. The first one is fear of the consequences. Not just fear of the consequences from the earthly authority, but also at the judgment seat, and secondly, for conscience' sake. But when it comes to submission to each other, there is only one overwhelming reason, and that is love. Now, I guess the word love doesn't seem to apply very much here, but he is building up an argument which says, well, look, the spirit in which you are going to obey these earthly authorities is the same spirit in which I expect to see you have your dealings with other people as well. And so we make that point there, that in verses 8 to 10, he's going to point that out. So that's sort of the positive side of things. When it comes to submission to each other, there is only one overwhelming reason, and that is this English word love, a word which of course needs to be defined in its context shortly. Alright? Pardon?
I think the last point I might do is emphasis in relation to the fact that though we might obey the law, it is not in itself righteousness, but that which motivates that obedience is what is righteousness. Paul says that the law is not made for the righteous, but for the ungodly and for the sinner. So on. In other words, law is there to control the flesh. What we need is, what you make, submission to the welfare and the well-being of other people. And in doing so, we don't need law. So we will obey the law, but we won't need it.
That can get you into a vicious circle where you say, well, because I don't need law, and because I'm liberated from it, I'm above law, therefore I will obey the... I know. I'm now putting the other side of where our fleshly mind can then start to reason. Now, I didn't want to detract... Your comments were excellent, Barry. Very, very good. And when you get to that point, as I said, it's very easy for the Christadelphian to say, well, because I'm liberated from that, I can get above it. So our conscience is not just a matter of saying, well, I think it's all right. Our conscience is, what does the earthly master say? He's been put there by God. My conscience is, I will obey him. And I'm not doing it just because the law says so, but because I want to. because I believe it is the right thing to do. So this word liberty is a thing that we have to treat very, very carefully. Liberty does not give us license. Liberty means we are liberated from law, but that doesn't give us license to therefore disobey the laws which we may be living under. I think I end up ruining your good comment, but...
I was going to add earlier that that passage in Peter, their comments that we should allow our liberty become a cloak of maliciousness. That is, that we say I'm adoptable because of what we see in Christ, and that we exercise maliciousness against the authorities. And there is a temptation to criticise the government and the local authorities for saying that.
Yes, I think somewhere down here we're going to get that too about our comments in regard to that governance. You know, we'll pick that up when we come to it. That quote in Peter, you got your NASB there? How does that quote in Peter go? 1 Peter 2, verse about 15 or 16 approximately, about the cloak of maliciousness. Well, if anyone's got one of the other translations, Mr. Pannon, I see coming out over there. Do not use your freedom as a covering for evil. That's good, isn't it? That's the point. See, this is it. We are free from whatever, the bondage of the law. We've been free from the condemnation, you might say, of eternal death. All of those sort of things we can reason out, but we mustn't use it as a covering for evil.
Moffat gives, live like free men, only never make your freedom a pretext for misconduct.
Live like free men, only never allow your freedom to be a pretext for misconduct.
Correct.
Have you got Moffat there, or did you just happen to have that quote in your margin?
No.
You don't own Moffat, do you?
No.
I didn't think you did. Not a very recommended one, but I thought you probably thought it was mine.
Truism is safe, and freedom brings responsibility.
Freedom
brings responsibility.
Yes, it does. Yes. You see, when a child is simply under law and you say, you can do this now, you can do that now, stop doing this, having to make decisions itself, it's got then a responsibility, hasn't it? And we can see that in the natural sense of the term as well.
So while you're free from the law, responsibility to behave in an acceptable manner in the circumstances.
So you see that in a business world. I mean, you find that yourself mixing, particularly in the sales area, all sorts of people, but you've got a certain standard of morality, a certain standard of integrity, and it's under challenge all the time, really, isn't it, in the world, that they're saying, oh, we slip this through and the government doesn't need to know about that and we don't have to pay tax on this unit and all that sort of thing, isn't it? Pressure's there all the time. And in the world, it's of course clever to do those sort of things. It's considered to be clever. But we have a responsibility to say, well, no, it's going to cost me more, but, well, that's the way it is.
Prominence that saints have always had historically. Like Habakkuk couldn't understand why the Assyrians, who were worse than the Jews, why they were being used to judge Israel. And because we're caught on blinded by the sight of our eyes, God doesn't rebuke us always through his word, but caught up through other people, and they're never perfect. So whether it's the Assyrians against Israel, the policemen against us, or even the people we work with rebuking us, while they themselves might be doing far worse things, we need to see past what we see and realise that that is God directing that rebuke and take no heed of that.
And Jonah would be another case in point too, wouldn't he? Couldn't understand why God would use the Ninevites to... He didn't want them to punish Israel because he thought Israel was just naturally better. All right. No further
comments? Well, we'll carry on then with the next verse in Romans 13, which is verse 6. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Now when he says, for this cause, he's really saying, because of what? As if we followed the reasoning. What does he mean, for this cause? Because of conscience, yes. I can only assume they sat there and diligently put their heads down in their notes that not too many had worked it out. Oh, well, perhaps that's being a bit unfair, but it is good every now and again just to see if you can follow Paul's reasoning through here. Yes, it's because of this, because of conscience toward God, and it is there in the notes too, because of conscience toward God, not just fear of being punished, but because of conscience toward God, pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing. The idea of tribute is explained as being the fact that it was a tax, an assessment on persons or property. The Romans made all conquered provinces pay this tribute, and it would become a question whether it was right to acknowledge their claim and to submit to it. This, of course, would be especially in the case of the Jews who had been converted to Christianity. They would find some difficulty in this. But I was very interested in the comment here, for they are God's ministers. And the Greek word there is liturgos, which means a public servant. Do you recall where that word or a similar word occurs somewhere else? Is it? How far? Yes, I reckon. Hebrews 12, verse 23. I don't know, what did that say? What did that say? Oh, you're looking for chapter 1, are you? Chapter 1, verse 14, says, are they not all ministering spirits? And it's speaking about the angels. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation? Now the diaglot says, are not they all public serving spirits, picking up that word ministering, are they not all public serving spirits? And when it says sent forth to minister, the diaglot says, for service on account of those being about to inherit salvation. So here we've got then the angels, who are public serving spirits. And of course, as in the natural sense, the public servant is the one ruling authorities and those who are the ruled. So it is with the angels. And they are ministering on our behalf, on God's behalf. And so they are the link, if you like, between God and man. They are the public serving spirits. So in that spiritual realm, we've got to recognise that they do encamp about the saints, that they are watching over the affairs of the kingdom of men, and they are public serving spirits. Now, of course, back in Romans chapter 13, he's talking about the other rulers which we can see, who are not spirits, they're very much flesh. But he does say they are nevertheless God's ministers. So God has two groups of ministers. He has the public serving spirits. They are the spirits sent forth to minister on behalf of those who are to be the heirs of salvation. But he also has the ministers according to the flesh. Nevertheless, we acknowledge both of them as being in existence, and we acknowledge that we are in the presence of both. So we give due service to the earthly ministers, acknowledging that the present, though invisible, ministering spirits are also attending to our needs and also conscious of what we are doing. So I was rather interested in the use of that word and its application in both the natural and in the spiritual sense. I think also back in Hebrews 1, was it in verse 7 as well? just sure on that. I thought there was another verse that had that in. Yes, it is in verse 7 of Hebrews 1. And of the angels he saith, and this is where the quote comes from, who maketh his angels spirits, and his, and the diaglot says, public servants, a flame of fire. His public servants, a flame of fire. So these people, back in Romans chapter 13 again, verse 6, these ministers of God, these earthly ministers, they are attending continually upon this very thing. We're told that the expression there, attending continually, the Greek word means to be earnest towards something, to persevere, to be constantly diligent. Vine says it denotes to continue steadfastly in a thing and give unremitting care to it. And he says that in Romans 13 verse 6, it refers to rulers in the discharge of their functions. So these people are continually attending upon these things. They are God's ministers continually. And many of them, of course, work very, very diligently, but they have no idea whatsoever that they are ministering on behalf of God. We do, however, and therefore we give service and respect to them because they are God's ministers, not because of what they are themselves. The Jerusalem Bible says, this is also the reason why you must pay taxes, since all government officials are God's officers. They serve God by collecting taxes. Fire. So these people, back in Romans chapter 13 again, verse 6, these ministers of God, these earthly ministers, they are attending continually upon this very thing. We're told that the expression there, attending continually, the Greek word, means to be earnest towards something, to persevere, to be constantly diligent. Vine says it denotes to continue steadfastly in a thing and give unremitting care to it. And he says that in Romans 13 verse 6, it refers to rulers in the discharge of their functions. So these people are continually attending upon these things. They are God's ministers continually. And many of them, of course, work very, very diligently, but they have no idea whatsoever that they are ministering on behalf of God. We do, however, and therefore we give service and respect to them because they are God's ministers, not because of what they are themselves. The Jerusalem Bible says, this is also the reason why you must pay taxes, since all government officials are God's officers. They serve God by collecting taxes. Well, that's the way the Jerusalem Bible translates it, or maybe paraphrases it. But that's really what it's saying, isn't it? What does yours say there, Stuart? Did I detect it? Looked interesting, or...
Verse 6.
Yeah.
For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing.
Yes. Yes, well, that's much the same as the King James, but the Jerusalem's just added that little bit on the end. They serve God by collecting taxes, which is the idea behind what is being said there. Such people in the world are consistently performing God's will, although they do not know it. We should emulate the same consistency from a different motivation. It is God's will that we should pay our taxes, even as Christ submitted to the laws of taxation. I'd like to go back to the quote in Matthew 17. No doubt many people would be familiar with the context in which this occurs, but really it supports very strongly what Paul has been saying here about the matter of conscience. Remember the story in Matthew chapter 17 where Peter had previously in chapter 16 declared that Jesus was the Christ and that Jesus had said to him, upon this rock I will build my ecclesia. And then the Lord took Peter into his confidence and pointed out to him that he was going to have to go down to Jerusalem and to suffer and to finally be killed but be raised again. And Peter challenged the Lord on this. He says, no, be it far from thee, Lord, this is not going to be under thee. The Lord responded by saying, "Well, get behind me, Satan, because you're a stumbling block to me." So Peter wasn't yet ready to receive this particular fact. He knew that Jesus was to be the Christ. He anticipated that therefore Jesus was going to be a king, but he didn't want it to be by means of suffering. So the Lord's conclusion is, "Peter, that sort of reasoning is not helpful to me at all. You're a stumbling block to me." So the matter is dropped temporarily as they go up into the mountain and witness the transfiguration. Coming down out of the mountain then, we take up the record from Matthew chapter 17 and verse 22. The Lord now sees fit to reintroduce this subject of the suffering, because having witnessed the transfiguration, he felt that Peter, James and John would now be better equipped to be able to cope with the idea that Jesus had to die before he should become a king. So verse 22 says, "And while they abode in Galilee, Jesus said unto them, The Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men, and they shall kill him, and the third day he shall be raised again." Now, this time the comment simply says, "And they were exceeding sorry." It doesn't say that they objected to it. However, they still had to learn something, and that was about stumbling blocks. Because you remember, Peter had been told that he was an offence, a stumbling block to the Lord. And if an ecclesia is going to be established and people like Peter are going to perform an important role, then one of the most significant things they've got to learn is not to put stumbling blocks before people, be they people within the ecclesia or people outside of the ecclesia. So verse 24 then says, "And when they were come to Capernaum, they that received the tribute money came to Peter and says, Doth not your master pay tribute? And he says, Yes. So the question came to Peter from these people, does your master pay the temple tax, which was the tribute money in this particular case, the didrachma? Not the same tribute as Paul talks about in Romans, but the same idea nevertheless. Does your master pay the temple tax? And he says, Yes. Well, that was a simple answer. Now the Lord, being cognizant of what took place, thought, now here's an opportunity to teach Peter, who's going to have to perform a very important role in the establishment of the ecclesia, an important principle that he must understand regarding stumbling blocks. When they came into the house, verse 25 says, Jesus prevented him. The word prevent really means to precede or to go before or to anticipate. So in anticipation of what was going to happen, the Lord says to Peter, what do you think, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers? Now this time he's talking about the Roman tribute. He's talking about the custom and the tribute which was paid, similarly to what we've got over in Romans. Now he said, you take the kings of the earth. Do they take tribute from their own sons, or do they take it from strangers? Now the answer was, as Peter gives him in verse 26, they take the tribute from strangers. So the Lord replies, in that case the children are free, they don't pay tax. And the answer was, that is correct. The rulers of the Roman world did not take tax from their own children, they only took it from strangers. Now what was Peter meant to learn out of that? Well, Peter was meant to learn this. Someone's just said to you, does this man here, Jesus, who is the Son of God, pay the tax to that temple, which is the temple of God? Does he pay the tax to the temple which belongs to his father? That was what it was all about. And the answer is yes. Now the Lord says, what about the Gentile rulers? Do they take tax from their sons? No. So the equation was meant to be interpreted as simple as this. If I wanted to demand my rights, I could say I don't have to pay the temple tax, because on the basis of common law, the son of the ruler does not pay the tax. It's only strangers. But I do pay the tax, don't I? Why do I pay it, Peter? Well, he doesn't give Peter a simple answer. What he tells him in verse 27 is, notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, cast a stumbling block in their way. The very thing, Peter, you were doing to me a while ago, which you've got to understand, Peter, is not the basis on which an ecclesia will be formed, lest we should put a stumbling block in the way of them. Now, the them he's talking about here are the tax collectors. And it was, of course, the tax collectors and those people that were the ones that were most responsive to the gospel, not the scribes and the Pharisees. They are the little ones of Matthew chapter 18. But the argument is, notwithstanding, lest we, Peter, should put a stumbling block in their way, you go down to the sea, cast in a hook, take up the fish that first cometh up, and when thou hast found, open his mouth, thou shalt find there a piece of money. And the expression, the piece of money, was actually a stater, which was equal to 4 drachma, which was the temple tax for 2 people. So he says, you go out, take it out of the fish's mouth, and you go and pay the tax for you and me. Now, that's a very, very quick overview of what he's saying here, but the lesson that comes out of it is this. Peter, I want you to understand that you and I know something that they don't know. You and I, Peter, know that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. You and I know, Peter, that on that basis an ecclesia is going to be built. However, Peter, you've got to learn that one of the most disastrous things that can be done in the promulgation of the truth, whether it to be people within the ecclesia or to those who may potentially come to a knowledge of the truth, one of the most disastrous things you can do is to put stumbling blocks in their way. Now, how can you put stumbling blocks in their way? You can put stumbling blocks in their way by either acting inconsistently with what these people know to be right, or even appearing to act inconsistently. And in this case, he took the illustration of his own situation where he says, I don't have to pay temple tax, but I am, because these people wouldn't understand it. If I said, look, I don't have to pay that tax, they would say, well, why doesn't he? It's not legal. He's disobeying the law. Therefore, he can't be a preacher of righteousness. We won't listen to him. So in order that he doesn't put a stumbling block in their way, he pays the tax. And you notice the way in which that theme is taken up in Matthew 18. I mean, very often, as far as Matthew 18 is concerned, all we hear about is verse 17. If he shall neglect to hear it, hear them, tell it unto the ecclesia. But if he neglect to hear the ecclesia, let him be unto thee as a heathen and a publican. As though that's sort of an axe that you can use when you want to withdraw fellowship from somebody. The fact is, of course, that Matthew 18 is completely the reverse of that. Matthew 18 is showing to us the principles upon which we redeem a brother. Now, it should never get to that stage. And if you look, for example, at verse 6 of chapter 18, whoso shall offend, put a stumbling block in the way of one of these little ones. Verse 7, woe unto the world because of stumbling blocks, for it must need be that stumbling blocks come. But woe to that man by whom the stumbling block comes. Where if thy hand or thy foot is a stumbling block, cut it off. Verse 9, if thine eye is a stumbling block, pluck it out. So, very briefly, he's saying that it's not just a matter of doing the right thing, but it's also a matter of the right thing being seen to be done in the eyes of the people who are witnessing it. Otherwise, it can cause a stumbling block to them. So there's a very good reason, therefore, why this matter of paying tribute, which is simply a token here of a greater principle of our attitude towards the rulers in society at large, that the right thing must not only be done, it must also be seen to be done. And in the Lord's case, he was very careful about that. We don't have to say a lot more about that at this stage, because that's going to become apparent, God willing, in chapter 14 of Romans, where we get onto the principle of meat offered to idols, which of course is the classic example of where the right thing needs to be seen to be done. So there was an illustration in the case of paying tribute, where the Lord was determined that he wanted the right thing to be done, and that there should not be a stumbling block put in the way of these people, such as the tax collectors, who are in fact the little ones of Matthew chapter 18. We know that by the cross reference in Luke. So, back in Romans chapter 13, we've just completed verse 6. And does anybody have any other comments then on where we've gone so far? We want to do just one more verse tonight, so we'll move straight on to that, and that's verse 7, which will bring us to the end of this first section. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, and honour to whom honour. The Jerusalem Bible says, pay every government official what he has a right to ask. whether it be direct tax or indirect, fear or honour. The word fear, of course, is the word which can mean alarm or terror. It means a solicitous anxiety lest we do anything to offend. We should stand in awe of those who wear the sword and who are appointed to execute the laws of the land and render to them that reverence which is appropriate to the execution of their office. And probably in many ways that summarises what we have seen in those first seven verses. So I'm going to leave it at that, but perhaps if there are any further comments you'd like to make while I'm still standing. If not, I will close it at that.
I'm not quite sure whether you just did away with the comments and questions. We do have a few minutes. If any of you have any questions, perhaps you could ask them for Brother John. See, there's no questions coming forth, then we'll ask for the announcements by another Brother John. Have any questions, no doubt, Brother Graham. I'll answer them later. Sounds very exciting, Graham. We'll conclude with prayer after we've sung the words of hymn number 226.